Following is an unrehearsed interview with Mrs. Martha Comer by Mary Jane Sharp for the Kentucky Oral History Commission. The interview was conducted at the Ledger Independent office on June the 22nd at 4 o'clock. This is side one. Okay, Mrs. Comer, can you give me some information about your farm, size, products?
I own two farms. One is 213 acres, and the other is 110. Now, those two farms are not quite large enough, Mrs. Sharp, to assure a productive income unless several factors are considered. The first being that I inherited the farm. The second is that I realized that I was a city person and needed an excellent farm manager. So I went to someone knowledgeable who handles my farm, and his name is William T. Cobb. Once upon a time, about 25 years ago, he had been declared Mason County's outstanding young farmer, and I knew of his ability through our soil conservation executor here, whose name, as you probably know, is Robert Carlisle. So Robert Carlisle suggested him. Mr. Cobb, being a neighbor, I employed him. The first practice, I said, I must, to go into farming today, which is why it's so sad, and why our farm population has declined to 6% and perhaps even less today, is that we can't attract the young people to farming because they do not have the money to buy a farm, and secondly, they lack the finances to purchase the enormous amount of modern-day equipment. Farm equipment has grown with technology in the same way that it has in every other phase of the industry. There isn't my neighbor across the way has a tractor that's air conditioned, for example, of course, Bill Cobb himself was one of those who helped to patent or build a new type of tobacco press that has almost done away with what was the greatest and most laborious effort on the farm, which is stripping of tobacco. And so now we have a way that we just feed the tobacco that's taken down from the barn and fed right into a press. Another man, as you know, probably well know, is T. Frank Jones, who has a similar type of equipment. So that, of course, it has made created a great labor-saving device. As I said, and the third thing that you have to have if you're going to run a farm is, aside from having inherited it, and secondly, having had some capital to finance these purchases, the third thing you have to have is an efficient farm operation, where you have to have somebody who knows what he's doing, knows soil, knows when to plant, when not to plant. And then I think the fourth thing that people have to have if they're going to be on the farm today is perhaps a second income. And the reason I say that, Mary Jane, is because the old class system largely endures here today, although I'm glad to say that it is fading. We still have what in the South is known as a sharecropper. Here we dignify it more by calling it the tenant farmer. And I have a tenant farmer who shares in half of all of my productivity. I pay the taxes, I buy the fertilizer, I make all the repairs. I pay for all those and I pay the taxes. He lives rent-free on a place. And if he even has a faucet that goes awry, I replace it. But that's part of our agreement. And he, in the contract with the tenant farmer, will have certain things which say, for example, that he will mow the entire farm once a year. And, of course, other times he does it for pay in order to keep it neat and nice. And he will do a certain amount of fence mending, that sort of thing. But, of course, ideally, to make a farm that is productive, I should think that you really ought to have 600 acres of land. I don't have that. Fortunately, I've met a woman who has had a job and still has a job, and I do have a second income. Mm-hmm. And I'm able to manage. And I'm very happy to say that after having been in the farm, Mary Jane, for 13 years, I was able to pay off the mortgage this spring. But it's taken me 13 mm-hmm. years.
Mm-hmm.
And here I am, a woman of 76 years old, and who went into debt over $65,000 13 years ago to bring back to life what was basically a very wonderful farm, located, as you must know, on Kentucky 11, 4 miles south of Maysville on the Fleming Road. This is just in case anyone wishes to know where it is.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that I have been so impressed with my farming activities is that Bill Cobb just did several things which I felt were essential and perhaps unique. Certainly it would have been unique for my husband to have done it. One of those things is that when the Wald Manufacturing Company was tearing down houses up here on Pelham Street, I bought a house for $50. We moved that house to my farm in the Plain Road, and I put it at the very edge of the land so people could think it was on my neighbor's farm. Yes, I did. And for $10,500, I moved that house, turned it around, put on a front porch. It already had a bath, you see. I built a septic tank and put in central heat so that I have a tenant who has a pleasant place to live. Put shutters on the front windows and generally made it attractive so mm-hmm. that he has a comfortable, warm place to live. If you're going to go and stay into farming and you want to do it as a woman who does not crop the land herself or a man cropping the land himself, he must provide in this relationship a decent, adequate place for a man to live. This was not true in my husband's lifetime or even as long ago as a generation. I felt the plight of the tenant farmer was pitiable. They had no bathrooms, they had no running water in the house, they had none of the modern. And of course, until REA came along in the mid-30s under Vice President Alvin Barkley, I think he gets a great deal of credit for that. And they called it REA, you remember what they called it, the Rural Electrification mm-hmm. Act, where you began to see all the farm homes in Mason County electrified. And of course, with that resurgence, and you began to see farm life much more endurable and livable. But meanwhile, the cost of running a farm has made it impossible for young people to buy land, and then the return is so meager compared to your investment. For example, you know, I went to court several years ago, and because they were taking frontage on my land,
mm-hmm.
and at that
mm-hmm.
time, just as a matter of record, they valued my property before the taking at, I would say, something like $577,000. And after the taking, my farm in the Fleming Road alone was valued at $560,000. Now, Mary Jane, there's not any way in the world that I can realize a 10% return on my investment. And I could have sold that farm, for example, and come to town mm-hmm. and put the land in treasury notes, and I'd been a great deal richer, but far less happier than in farming. I think that farming is, to me, has become a way of life because I have become a staunch conservationist. If you were to drive out the Fleming Road, you will see that it is very sparsely populated because there are about a half a dozen, maybe a dozen of us who are firmly committed that we are not going to submit to the invasion of suburbia into our farmland or not. I had to give up a couple of acres at the front of my farm and tear down all my oak trees, which I felt was a crime.
Mm-hmm.
They were primeval oaks, and they're gone. But anyway, as a sop to modern-day travel, I'm going to have a good highway, okay? As I said, I did say that fourth thing is a second income. Now, that takes care now, just to tell you a little bit briefly about any kind of a farm operation, if you decide to, whatever phase you're going to go into, the first essential ingredient of anything, aside from good soil and, of course, favorable weather conditions, is that you have to have water. And one of the things that I had my late husband to do back in the 1960s, and which really has benefited farming tremendously, has been a creation of the rural water districts, you know, mm-hmm. of Western Mesa, I mean, not Western Mesa County, but the one down at Dover, at the, that started, that was the first rural water district in the county. Mm-hmm. After my husband had a heart attack, I said, why don't you get one started? And it really, I think, prolonged his life for years, because we have a water district, and I have city water. One of the things that I have done is that in every field on my farm, especially the one in the Fleming Road, to which I've devoted most attention, is I have water in every field. And where I once was in to Darien, and see, what people don't realize is that if you're a dairy farmer, this is something you've got to do 365 days a year every morning.
Are you a
morning.
Dairy farmer now?
I was a dairy farmer, okay. Every morning and every night. And right before my husband died, my tenant farmer came in one day and said, I have milked my last cow. And so then before my husband died, he said, this will be something to assure your future if I die, as I expected to die. But what really happened is that he outlived the usefulness of my dairy, which I then sold in. So now I'm into it. A beef cattle operation, I am into wheat and corn, and into berry tobacco. And very frankly, I think the future of tobacco, the future of farming in Mason County is terribly precarious, because if you go anywhere today, you may see two persons in a room smoking. If berry tobacco goes, and you realize that that is 52% of the income in Mason County for farming, that if berry tobacco goes, as it very well might go, with the move of Congress and the impact on cancer, of talk of cancer, I don't know what's going to replace it. It is our money crop. I was able to pay off the mortgage, for example, last year for the simple reason that we were allowed a 5% increase in our production. And what did we all do? Everyone around here just simply, I think we produced, wasn't $100 million worth of income that was mm-hmm. produced from berry tobacco here at Maysville and at Ripley, Ohio. Just think of what $100 million does, but it's poured into our economy in a period of 3 months' time. That may very well be wiped away if subsidies stop and if we have no controls. The other advantage, I think, to farm living, and I hope I'm not wandering from the field, please tell me if I am. What farming does is it's a character-building asset, Mary Jane. I've had to learn patience. I've had to learn to loss of pride. I had people at my dinner Monday night, and because tobacco crop was so late this year, couldn't get the front woods cut. The first thing my son-in-law said when he brought all these 16 or 18 geologists up from Louisiana, he didn't get the front woods cut. I said, no, all the tobacco hasn't been planted. There wasn't any time to get that done. So, of course, you see pride, patience, the ability to live with failure, crop failure, mm-hmm. loss of, you know, all those things are assets of farm living that I don't think that the urban dweller appreciates to the extent of. See, we're at the mercy. We're at God's mercy. We're at God's mercy, if you wish to say that. Mm-hmm. Okay?
Well, do you recall what the worst year was in terms of crop production? Maybe there was, you know, a hailstorm, and how did you all manage with during this time?
I can remember during the Great Depression, my husband told me that I couldn't spend $5 a week on groceries, and yet I was a working woman even then.
Now, you were living on a farm at that time.
I went to the farm as a young woman without.
Were you reared on a farm?
No. I was reared in town, and I married a farmer, and I went to his home place. Mm-hmm. Which did not have a bath, and which did not have running water. And we were so poor in those days that Pat didn't milk the cows. He would bring the milk up to the house. He may have milked some. He'd bring the milk up to the house, and we were straining it up. It's been very difficult sometimes me to drink a glass of milk, and I think of straightening all that awful nasty hair. And then here he was, supposedly a gentleman farmer. If you know, I'm making a distinction here, because a gentleman farmer is one who doesn't ever raise his own tobacco, for example. That is not what a gentleman farmer does. He has a tenant who does that. He may do something, and that the he won't even plant his own corn. He may do wheat harvesting, or he may do some of those things that are what they call custom farming, but he's not going. He doesn't go out. That, my husband lived and died without ever having stripped a pound of the back of his life. That's right. And this is true of all farmers. It's just a way of life. Hmm. He did not do that.
He didn't have another career, did he?
Well, as a matter of fact, yes, he became a tobacco grader. You always had to have a supplementary income, you know, even
when
tobacco grader.
For you at this time, were you working?
Yes, we lost our first child, and of course, I was pretty, but as I said, I lived on the farm without electric, without water. I cooked on the coal stove. Heck, here I was, a city girl. I just thought it'd be great fun to go out there and conquer the elements. And so, of course, you know, it was always hard to find out which had the hotter face. The stovepipe going up should be blood red, and my face too, as I was trying to prepare a summer meal for maybe 40 hands, you know, all that sort of thing. And the old days before you had all the modern day mechanisms. Mm-hmm. We were poor, just poorer than church mice. We left the farm for a while because my mother-in-law died, and I lost my first child, and it was a traumatic experience, and I went back to work, and then subsequently I had two children. We had the 1937 flood, which put my house in Tennessee. In the meantime, right after losing my first child, and my brother died, and when I had a 6-month-old baby, and I was plunged back into the newspaper business for the rest of my life. So I've just worked all my life.
Was that a choice that you wanted to make?
Well,
necessity?
I think, Mary Jane, that if my brother hadn't died, and of course I've taken great refuge in the fact that I was forced back in the newspaper business.
Uh-huh.
But the truth be known, I really have been a career woman all my life. All I ever wanted to do was to write.
Uh-huh.
And that's why I find farming so fascinating, because I'm interested in all the conservation aspects of it, and I like seeing things growing. I just love to see a seed go into the ground, and all of a sudden it flourishes like a green bay tree. It's fascinating. Really, truly is. It's a whole new way of life. And as I said, it's taught me virtues which I never had as a newspaper woman. You know, a newspaper editor wraps up a package every day and says, yes, your mistake, or yes, your success. It is, and then you start the whole process over the next day. And so here was a woman who was always able to get today's job done today. And I go to farm life and bang, everything is up to Manana. That's on the next month. I'll get around to fixing this next month. All right.
Okay, so like during like 37 flood, you mentioned that, and some I'm sure very difficult years on the farm. Did your children go through tremendous hardships or?
Oh no. See, I think one of the most interesting aspects of my Jane between the modern day woman and the modern day working mother today, and those of us who grew up in the 30s. And had our babies in the 30s, is that there was a time when we didn't have a maid. Isn't that an anomaly?
Oh,
we
really?
Only paid them $3 a week.
But you had a maid.
You have a maid. You have a nursemaid. Of course, I always justified having a nurse baby because I had to go back to work, don't you say? See, it was a rationalization. Probably had no basis in fact at all. All of us had maids. I don't know. You know, we may have done. I may have worn the same coat for 10 years, which I did. And of course, you know, those early days were the prohibition years, and so you didn't. I can remember an era when we all rolled our own cigarettes, okay?
Uh-huh.
And we all drank them. If those of us who liked to drink, I was never much of a drinker. Those of us who drank that drink on moonshine, okay? We all had gardens. We all, and during World War II, we all just canned and put things into the freezer until we became nauseated with it. I wouldn't can anything today under any circumstances. But we were wandering from a field. I asked you another question.
Okay. I was just wondering about with your family and your children, what role did education and religion play back at that time? For example, were your children, did they work on the farm and have to miss days of school? Was that, you know, there are some school systems today that work around.
Well, that was true, of course, other people. You must see that as, for example, let's take my cousin Ed Comer up the road, my husband's cousin Ed Comer. I imagine at harvesting time some of his children gone in the fields, and I'm sure that But no, I was a Roman Catholic. I am a Roman Catholic, Mary Jane, and I felt that if I worked in town for a newspaper, then I was obligated morally for my children to come to St. Patrick's School in town. It was a hardship. In a day of our life today, when I see all these children being transported, the woman who lived up the road picked up my children every morning, and I paid $2 and a half a week to transport them, and it was a hardship. I didn't have that $2 and a half a week. Mm-hmm. There wasn't any money around. Mm-hmm.
Were your children expected to do duties on the farm? Did they have their chores, so to speak, at the time? And did they enter into the
Not really, because you must understand, you're talking about a landlord-tenant relationship. Uh-huh. Now, the tenant's child would have done that, but you must remember that you're talking to a woman whose husband was a landlord.
Mm-hmm.
And so, of course, they did pick vegetables from the garden and do that sort of thing, but and they did follow the men working on the farm around, did things like that, and they learned very early about, the farm child learns very quickly about heredity the facts of life, you want to call any term you want to use, you know. If a dog had pups, Barbara would run up to the house and say, "Mother, I could keep him. It's a he dog."
Uh-huh.
She knew right away. There she was, the age of 4 or 5. They knew right away the sexes of dogs and how babies came and all that sort of thing. There was no mystery to them. And this is, to me, one of the joys of farm living.
Mm-hmm.
But the hardships that we had were we didn't get to travel. We never owned a house except one that belonged to my in-laws, so to speak. When you young people talk today about wanting to buy a house, I think they must be crazy. I lived half my life in an upstairs apartment when I actually came back to Maysville. When the children got up to school age and were in school and World War II came along, I abandoned farm living. I had to decide which were my priorities. A, I had to run a newspaper. Two, I had to see my children. So I moved to town, lived down here on Front Street, 5 minutes away from the newspaper office, where I could run home and stick a thermometer in their mouth if they had a cold or something like that, and then take an extra hour at supper to watch their homework.
Mm-hmm.
My children came to St. Patrick's School and finished the high school here, and then went on to have a liberal arts education. That's the end of their being, and of course, I live alone now, as you know, and neither one of them is here. So this is one of the things that I think is one of our small town tragedies. We don't seem to have enough here to keep young people in Maysville. They seem to go elsewhere.
So what you mentioned some things that, well, first off, that you used to have a dairy farm. What was the big reason for the change from dairy to the products you now have? Is it financial, more profit?
Well,
more work.
As I said, we'd had the tenant farmer had boys who helped him milk morning and night. Those boys grew up. Pat had the same tenant for 22 years, and about 20 years before he died, and then I kept him on for 2 or 3 years thereafter. And he wouldn't do the things that I wanted him to do. I am a reasonably efficient and productive person. I went fences on the farm. With gates, fences maintained, and gates closed so cattle won't wander off. I want the back of barns cleaned out of manure and stuff like that. I don't want a horrible looking place to live.
Mm-hmm.
And so we came to a break into the ways, and I didn't have anybody to operate the dairy. We sold it. And so then I converted all those milk cows into what they call a crossbreed type of cow, but somebody might call the all great American dog. Oh, yeah. I have all great American cattle, okay?
Uh-huh. Okay.
I have one tenant living on my farm, and I find this interesting, sociologically speaking. I have a man who lives on the other farm whose name is Arvel Dahl, and he's lived on that farm for 60 years.
Wow.
It is interesting, and he has not
he's
farmed.
He's a tenant.
Well, and, he's no longer a tenant, because the tenant mm-hmm. that I have on lives mm-hmm. on my farm where I live,
yeah.
operates both farms.
Uh-huh.
But you see, one of the things that I think is interesting, and would be interesting to you as a sociologist, is that peer pressure would destroy me Mary Jane, if I were to go to Orville Doyle and say to him, Orville, you can't live here anymore without paying rent. So Orville Doyle is going to live in my farm until the day he dies and not ever pay me a day's rent. I feel, and my neighbors would feel, and my farm manager would feel, that he has earned the right to live there rent-free. And if it has any terrible maintenance, such as a roof leaking or something like that, then I'd have to take those repairs. But I could never charge him a penny of rent. Do you understand that sort of an arrangement? See, this is what this knowing as being a good neighbor in the country. And that spirit still exists.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure that it always does in town. But country neighbors are country living. Country living is a totally different ballgame. I'm not saying that the neighbors next door don't bring in food or stuff. But you know, how many stories do you know about? Somebody has, the man is broken his back or something like that, and everybody else goes in and brings in his crop. Isn't that true?
Mm-hmm.
That spirit exists today. But are we wandering?
No, we're doing fine. I'm just looking over some questions here. I'll see. Okay, so basically you had a husband who worked on a farm and went on to become a tobacco grader. You took on you were working full-time here at the paper, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Part-time type of job. And over the years, you have seen a lot of automation come about in terms of refrigeration. If you were with the dairy, I'm sure you saw refrigeration.
Oh, yes. We had a full-time. We had milking machines.
Uh-huh.
We had that big refrigerated tank. We had the whole works.
Uh-huh.
And of course, we were inspected repeatedly, you know, by the Board of Health.
Mm-hmm.
You must meet all requirements, you know,
mm-hmm.
that sort of thing.
But about when did that come about?
My husband died in 1957. I know my husband had a heart attack in 1957, and so we abandoned dairy in 1969. As soon as it became apparent he wasn't going to die, he said, well, I'll convert the farm to a dairy farm, and then you'll be assured of an income after I'm dead, and it'll be a return on your investment. And instead, he died in 1970.
Side two of an interview with Mrs. Martha Comer.
When I went out to the country to live in November of 1970, I had remodeled the house and done certain essential things. I discovered that we had hogs on the farm, and my fencing was very inadequate. And I had small grandchildren there who, and of course, you know, the hog is the most fascinating of all animals, and the smartest. And my children, they were in a nearby field, and the children wanted to go over there and get near a sow, and she spared and hurt her pigs, and then, you know, I could have had a dead grandchild. And since we weren't really equipped for that type of farming, I went completely into what they call a beef cattle operation.
Mm-hmm.
And to have beef cattle, you know, you must have adequate pasture land. One of the things which has been accomplished on my farm, and which Bill Cobb told me to say to you in my interview, is that there isn't a better farm in Mason County than the one on which I live. It has good soil, and while my husband had allowed it to grow up because of ill health and perhaps extra trees and things of that sort, that, in other words, as the trees grew out, what they would do in a field, they just would plow the center of the field or out to where the trees were and let it go. Now, what he did, and what has been so remarkable about my farm, is that he would take a bulldozer. I had bulldozed about 50 acres. I'm not saying, I don't want you to think of a 50-acre tract, Mary Jane, where they simply gone in and bulldozed. What I'm saying to you, they've gone on this field and they've cleaned out that area, and I maybe put up France this year, for example. I can't take a trip anywhere because I spent $5,000 on necessary fencing between my farm and my neighbor's farm. One of the things, you know, that remember Robert Frost and what he said about fences making for good neighbors. Well, last year, a neighbor jumped over his bull, climbed the fence, or maybe my cow climbed the fence, I don't know which. And anyway, I turned up for several young Hereford heifers, okay, or maybe young steers. They just, not Hereford, I mean, what am I trying to say? What's the black and white cattle that are dairy cattle, you know what I mean?
Holstein.
That's right. You know, anyway, so What I had to do was to rebuild, and then he went ahead and fixed his end. And so now we have good fences between two neighbors. And I won't have any corn damage that I did last year. I won't have any tobacco damage as a result of that. It was really his part of the fence that damaged my tobacco and corn. But whenever Ralph Frost wrote that about good fences makes good neighbors, I'm sure he must have had some farm operation in mind. Okay.
Well, let's talk, if we will, a little bit about, you mentioned the roadway that came through and took the front part of the land and things like this. I think I think everybody's aware of the growth and the new industry in Maysville. What do you think about all this growth? It is hurting the farmland.
Oh, there's no doubt about that.
And what about the byproducts, like the increased population and the additional highways and the more of the drain on the utilities?
Of course, I think that...
you've seen the past. You're certainly here in the present, and I think you're in a situation to see what will happen in the future or predict what might happen in the future. What about your farm?
I happen to be... one of the things that I have done is I happen to live in an antebellum house, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It was occupied by 1850 or thereabouts, okay. So what I did is put my house in the National Register. So that means they really can't do much to destroy the immediate 50 to 40 acres in front of my house. So I'll keep that from what I call the pollution of suburbia.
Mm-hmm.
See, I think that suburbia came about as a result, really, in this area of the Civil Rights Movement in the 1960s. There had been a certain burgeoning of people desiring to have their own little plot of ground in the country, but the real impetus, as far as I'm concerned, and I was terribly involved in the Civil Rights Movement, is that people fled the suburbs because they didn't want the blacks going to school with white children in town. And I'm sorry, but I do believe that's true. I don't know, isn't there some statistic around that 4 billion acres of land are taken out of production every year to make ways for new highways?
Something.
Mm-hmm. It's some enormous figure.
Something.
Now, my daughter and I disagree. I said, Mary Patrick, this is going to be a wonderful highway when it's completed. I won't have to be afraid of getting stuck on the side of the road or skidding around in the ice. And she said, Mother, there's no compensation in the world for the 2 acres of land and all the trees that the government took. You know, I want to pull over it.
Uh-huh.
It's a very interesting situation. But I'm the only one who sued. But I was, and I think the other desecration of the land that has occurred is what the High Valley Fire Company did. It came in here about 6 or 7 years ago. And they took an easement on my other farm, and I had one of those monstrous electric wire things that goes up on my farm, and I couldn't keep them from doing that. See, this is what the law ought to protect farming interests better. They always say they're going to do, but I think that one of the most lamentable failures that we have in our country, and I'd love to be recorded on this, is the idea of zoning and land protection laws. They just don't work. I know that James Watts has gotten a lot of flack, but that stuff has never been allowed. We've always abused the farmer. If you suppose in 1 minute that if Mitchell Denham, who bought that land next to me, were to put a subdivision up there, and if I, for example, happened to be into the hog business, the hogs smell, and they really smell. If I had, say, a dozen pigs located next door to them, land, and you live in the house next door, I'm quite sure you could go to the courthouse or go to court and you could force a judge to say that I had to get in my house because they were polluting the environment, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So that I don't think the farmers have as much protection. And what is there left but the land? What are we going to have but the land?
Well, where do you think all this change started or came about as you look past over your past and through your life? You know, I'm sure at one point the farmer was, he had most of the land and everything was profitable for him at that time. What really happened? Well, you mentioned civil rights.
Well, of course, what really happened, you have to go back to the Industrial and Commercial Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
The minute that we had a capitalist society and the feudal conscience was no longer told that it was a sin to make a profit. And I do think that in journalism days, they were taught that, you know, look at how Shylock in The Merchant of Venice, you know, look how he was at hard. Mm-hmm. We really thought that making profit was not essential to the good life. And then all of a sudden, profit-making came into our thinking, and people became more and more commercial-minded. And let's just face it, farm life's not for everybody. It's a hard life. I heard Jean Aiken, when you were talking about it in your dream, she said, tell Mary Jane Sharp and you tell her that all farmers are gamblers, and that they gamble 13 months a year and have to work 13 months a year. What she really was meant to, they have to work from sun up to sunset. Mm-hmm. And she said, we gamble with the weather, we gamble with the lack of rain, we gamble with drought. You know, one of the worst droughts that occurred in Mason County, and you ought to remember this, occurred in 1931. We had a pair of pine trees in the front of my house which simply died. And I've often thought, you know, Mr. Hoover tried to do something about the enormous wheat problem in the nation. And Mr. Roosevelt came into power, and he succeeded a little bit better with one of his phases in the New Deal program. Mm-hmm. New Deal program. But one of the things that really helped him to succeed is that we had that enormous drought. We had the Dust Bowl in Kansas, and we had enormous dust storms here in this area. So that God intervened, perhaps you want to call, or the gods intervened, perhaps you want to call it that way, and helped to salvage a part of Mr. Roosevelt's attempt to help the farmers. See, there's been a lot of talk this year about something called payment in kind. Are you familiar with that term?
Yes, somewhat.
Well, payment in kind is that I have taken, for example, something like 12 acres in my own particular case, mm-hmm. of corn out of production this year.
Yeah.
And I'm going to get, I think, Mr. Cobb told me, $1,350 back. I wish I had to give half of that to my tenant. You see, one of the most interesting things about farming is that you must take the tenant's word. When I have my hay baled, for example, Philip Cobb, or if I'm buying grass, he'll just give me a slip of paper in which he has 15 bushels of bluegrass seed, or he'll say so many hundreds of bales of straw or corn or whatever, not corn, of course, or hay, anything that he's baling. He just simply says what the price is. They don't have how many hours of labor or anything. You just have to take their word. Mm-hmm. And so then I just sit down and write a check for the amount. Mm-hmm. I don't know if a businessman in the community would not scrutinize every aspect of that sort of an arrangement. But on the farm, you take it for granted.
Mm-hmm. That's true. Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned that drought back in the early 30s, 31. Financial, for example, with your farm and other area farmers at that time, what happened to them financially? Did some of them go under? Did some of them lose their...
Oh, of course they went under.
Lost their land and their...
Partially, my father-in-law did not have any debt and was a very thrifty man.
Mm-hmm.
And who lived very frugally. And at one point in time, my husband had wanted to be a doctor, and his mother became terribly ill, and she tried all the doctors. She ended up with her chiropractor. Pat went away and studied chiropractic. He came back here and got established for about 18 months, and all of a sudden his father decided that he was going to give up farming. And so there my husband had to, he couldn't manage at that time, his brother still was in New York, on the stock market. Francis Gomer's on the stock market in New York. And of course it collapsed,
mm-hmm.
and Francis had gone to Villanova, had come back home, and they both then Francis married, and there were three families, all living out of one hand. And the direct part about it, Mary Jane, is that Mr. Comer controlled the purse string. My father-in-law, I'm speaking of, not my mm-hmm. husband. I remember one year, having lost a child, I was always a person who liked to study, and I wanted to take a course in Shakespeare. I hadn't got to finish college. I was very bitter about it, but there wasn't enough money. I had only had a year of formal education in college. The old man said, there isn't any more money, Martha. You can't go, okay? That's one of the hazards of the Depression. So I asked Pat if he had the money. And he brought the $15 back to the City University of Kentucky to come down here and give classes to up in Maysville High School, because the main teachers then did not have their degrees. And I picked up, I guess, 20, 25 credits in various subjects, history, and I had a wonderful course in Renaissance literature and Shakespeare and Brown. I just had a number of cultural courses that certainly enriched my enjoyment of life. But to go back to the Shakespeare story, Mr. Comer said that he had to give my husband, think of the indignity of it, he had to give my husband the $15 a meter enrolled in that course. And Mr. Comer said to Pat Comer, my husband, it'd be better to learn how to sew and so study Shakespeare.
That's what I was wondering about. And what about at the time that you came back to work and or started working? How did people in the area in Mason County think about you working?
Well, of course, so they said, poor Martha.
Yeah, poor Martha. Patrick, because your wife's not at home.
We had a morning newspaper, so I always had the mornings home. And then having been an employer's daughter, I'm not saying I didn't do a lot of extra work, but I've always had a maid. I mean, I'm telling you that all of my contemporaries all had maids. They did pity me because I was the only working woman among all of them, the others. And I suffered terrible pangs of guilt.
Oh, really?
Fear that I was neglecting my children.
Yeah.
That's true. Very, very much so.
Yeah.
But, of course, as a matter of fact, since I was relieved, you see, I never had a dish. I don't have dishwashers to this day. I never had a washer and dryer when my children were babies. And, of course, you were always losing maids. You know, I know it sounds like an ideal existence. And think of going home on a Sunday night at 11:30 at night and facing a whole bathtub filled with dirty diapers. And they were the bird's eye, the square kind. And so, and having lost a child, I was a fool. So that not only did I boil them, okay? So there would be no hint of contagion for my, on the beautiful hinds of my daughters, okay? No fear of contagion. Then I have to hang them out on the line. And actually, when the maid would come, she'd have to iron them. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Can you believe it? In the day of pampers, can you really believe it? And all of my contemporaries had their diapers ironed. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Interesting, isn't it? That's one sidelight that I might bring on to the old scene.
But you overall think that your children benefited from the farm life?
Well, of course, I was one of those persons who refused to have a television in my home. And my children didn't have a television after their father had a heart attack in 1957. Barbara had already graduated from college, and my Patrick was probably sophomore. I just knew there was something with which I could not cope. I didn't have radio, and we did have free movie passes because I was, again, in the newspaper business.
Mm-hmm.
So they saw all the movies in town, there's no doubt about that. But they were not exposed to the insidious influences of television. And consequently, they're both readers. See, with the computer coming along, and I'm getting ready to write this story now about what will the computer do to change our lifestyle, and I'm reading that there'll be screens in the wall where children can just read, but they're not ever going to know the fun, and I am wondering here, they're not ever going to know the fun of picking up a book and reading and chucking out yourself in utter delight at the exquisite turn of a phrase.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just kind of a solid laughter that encompasses one when you and a book become almost one person.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, there's no joy. And this is what if I had to say anything, that I feel sorry for you young people today and for my grandchildren, that most of them do not know that wonderful, special joy. We didn't have anything else.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, after all, radio came along when I was in high school, and we didn't have a radio, I guess, until I graduated from high school. And, of course, I think the reason my father lived to be almost 99 is that he never drove a car. He walked everywhere. And so we were all walkers. We walked to school, I think, for the ridiculousness of the city school system, not allowing those kids to walk up there to Forest Avenue when we're all into jogging. You know, it's almost a hysterically funny paradox, isn't
mm-hmm.
it? But I don't mean to wander off.
You're talking
about farming. You really are talking about farming.
Doing fine. What about, let me go back a few years again also. What about the doctors and vets and as far as looking after the
animals. Well, of course, you see, nowadays, everybody just, normally, someone said, what's those tags doing in the ears of those cattle?
Yeah.
See, they're all tagged today. We
right.
didn't have anything that because we find it because of forage.
Uh-huh.
We didn't put all the lime and the fertilizer that we do now. I have a $3,000, right out of $3,000 fertilizer bill every year that always just sort of makes me sick. The payment in kind. See, I'll make a little bit of money there this year because I don't have to buy quite as much fertilizer. See, corn takes so much nitrogen from the soil,
mm-hmm.
Mary Jane, that you really have to use great quantities of fertilizer. And so I don't have to buy quite as much corn fertilizer for nitrogen for replacement. And if you're a conservationist, you do know about terracing. See, one of the greatest things that has happened to save soil erosion in Mason County is a conservation district which has been created now. I think it's 25 to 30 years old. People now know all about what they call contour planting and terracing, and they know not to go make a straight row. They know all those sort of things.
Mm-hmm.
There's never any practice in my husband's youth or mine. So farming may be mechanized, but it's also become technologically successful because people on the farm are as knowledgeable today about implants. You know, I'm dying to put into all my cattle something called an implant. There's a name for it, which I've forgotten. But if I put an implant in, they will gain as much as 30 pounds in the first 3 months.
Oh,
see, yes, it's just marvelous. But all that costs money, you understand, and you have to keep a pretty firm check. You want to talk about one of the most harrowing experiences of my life was when I went in to borrow money for the first time on a grand scale in 1970 after my husband died. And I was talking about starting out borrowing $25,000 and ended up $65,000 in debt on that farm when I was past 60 years old. Talk about worrying in your sleep. That's what I was worried about, my dear. And I was turned off right away. The banker said to me, I have to have a report on the financial resources. And I was so frightened, I said, I'll come back and see you tomorrow. And then, just for the record, I went across the street to another banker, and I met a friend of my husband who we talked about our children for a long time and his children and how fond he had been. And my late husband went on and on and on. About 15, 20 minutes later, he said, of course, it's just a routine that you have to give me a financial report. And by that time, I had been sucked in, okay? So there I was, going out to the farm, living out there, as a woman past 60 years old. I mean, after all, I'm 76 now, so you know, there I was, $65,000 in debt. And then since I was so old, they wouldn't give me a time mortgage. You know, have you ever bought anything on mortgage? You know
yeah,
that.
Well, yeah, I know what you're referring
to. See, I couldn't buy it at a fixed rate of interest, so of course, I've lived on a farm to see interest accelerate from 6% to 17%. I remember calling the bank 2 or 3 years ago and complaining to somebody that I only owed about two-thirds of what I owed less than two-thirds of what I had done 13 or 10 years ago, and I was paying almost as much interest. Of course, the great salvation of the farmer, and for that matter, of the property owner, is our tax system, is that we are allowed to exempt from mm-hmm. our income tax, the amount of money that we borrow for the farm or for your house or for whatever, or even for a pleasure trip, and the taxes that we pay. So that truly for the wealthy, for our doctors here, you know, certainly a farm is a tax shelter. And if I were advising city people if they really had money to spare, I would suggest to them that they become interested in farming, if for no other, for economic reasons. It may not be, I'm talking about persons who are in the higher income tax, right?
Mm-hmm.
But see, I can deduct Mary Jane, so too can the farmer. If he buys a $35,000 tractor, and that's what the cost, I think, if he buys a $35,000 tractor, he can not only depreciate the cost of the tractor, but he also can take off the amount of interest he has to pay for the bank every year. Mm-hmm. So you see, it is in a very real sense a tax shelter. Mm-hmm. And then I think I'm rich. I mean, not in a financial sense, but I think I'm rich because I have land, which I'm going to guard zealously so that it will go to my children and hopefully somebody else in posterity, if not to them. Mm-hmm. It's our most precious resource, mm-hmm. It and our abundant water here from the Ohio River.
But farming in and of itself, not just particularly in this area, is not a profitable business, do you think, today? Don't you think it takes a dual career family to...
That's right. Mm-hmm. See, almost all of them. I could not have lived in the farm and managed the last 13 years if I had not had the good fortune to have remained editor of this paper full-time for 6 years.
And what happened, do you think, that farms at one point were very... they could support themselves.
Well, they're agrarian. Their agrarian lifestyle ended.
Mm-hmm.
It ended, I would say, really, in the early 1920s. And, of course, you see what really happened in the 1920s is we had no farm controls, no farm subsidies, so that, of course, people were, in order just to make ends meet, were just growing tobacco, and they were selling it for 3 and 4 cents a pound. You see, one real worth $1.85 last year?
Mm-hmm.
Think of that vast difference.
Mm-hmm.
And I 52% of the farmers' income in Mason County, where it comes, you know, the statistics comes from tobacco. And that's why I think that we're in such a precarious state for the future. And, of course, until those men in Congress realize that farming has to be made a profitable venture, even if it has to be subsidized. Isn't it subsidized in France? I think if you were to look into, I'm sure if you were to look into the French system, mm-hmm. you would see, and of course they all belong to the European common market, I'm sure that you would find that farming in France is very highly subsidized. You have to be dedicated to be a farmer. You must be out there in that blazing sun. You've heard all this stuff about
mm-hmm.
skin cancers. Are out there in that blazing sun, working from all that kind of stuff, working against rain and drought and pestilence, if you want to call it that. Isn't it supposed to be the year of the locusts again?
Locusts again,
it's
or
the
early,
year
of the locusts with the
same. Okay.
But it takes, you know, I can just imagine that would take a very... takes a gambler, as you said, even more so today than in the past, I think.
If you inherit a farm and you like outdoor living, you like independence, you like being your own man, you like keeping books, you like the joy of seeing things grow, and you love the wonderful freshness of the air, and you like solitude. See, the farmer is a solitary person. He spends good many of his waking hours alone
mm-hmm.
with his own thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe that's one of the reasons I think the farmers, for whom I know, I think, basically have a great sense of integrity and personal worth. They, I would no more introduce my tenant farmer as a tenant. I mean, it's like using the word sharecropper. I said, this is a man who helps me on the farm or helps run my farm. I don't call him my tenant. That's a denigrating word.
Mm-hmm.
He's as good as I am, and he tithes as much as I am.
Mm-hmm.
And I accept his word.
So you really, I don't know if blame would be the correct word, but you more or less blame government intervention for the lack of support farmers have. Some people would say it's just growing technology, that the farmers need to realize they're fading out. It's an industrialized nation. The government needs to do these sort of things. And in addition to that, what do you think is the...
Well, I think it's going to happen. I'll tell you what I think is going to happen.
With Mason County?
No,
and with
I think what's going to happen everywhere is that you're going to, when farmers get tired, you're going to find these great big outfits, the Exxon. I just use that as the person popped in my mind. They're all going to buy up our land, those of us who do not have any money to spare. And then they're going to they're going to organize. See, the farmer is the most unorganized man in the world. He just really resents, A, government intervention, and B, he resents forming a union. He doesn't have a union to protect his own rights, so he's not union.
Side 3 with the interview with Mrs. Martha Comer.
Once they buy up our thousands of acres of land, and to see what can be done, they can eliminate fences, and they can bring in those enormous equipments, pieces of equipment, and they can bulldoze out all our trees, for example, which a farmer guards so zealously, and they can just do mass production of farming. And then they will be able to dictate their own terms. You see, right now, the farmer is the only person I know who can't set a price on his commodity. So once that day happens, Mary Jane, well then you'll see these great big, they'll own the land, and they'll tell you, they'll set their price. Just like the natural gas industry now, I'm not talking about the petroleum producers, I'm talking about the transmission companies such as Columbia and Texas, those outfits. They have really are gouging those of us who have to heat our house with natural gas. And I am in favor of deregulation, for example. But anyway, that's what might happen. It very well might happen. And then you're going to see the total disappearance of a way of life that has engendered healthy, strong children. You know, I did say the kids didn't do anything, but of course they'd go down and gather eggs from the hen house. And they do things like that because, of course, they were girl children. They were not old enough yet to do any farm living. We were back in town by the time they were 11 or 12, you see. I mean, Barbara was 11 or 12 when we were back in town. So they hadn't had that much exposure to actual farming. Mm-hmm. But I'm sure there's a lot of kids in the farm today. My neighbor's boys pick up cash money. So they mow my grass, and they help with tobacco and all that sort of stuff. Family, you really ought to interview Mary Jane as an example of an outstanding family who has made who have a productive farm and who does his own farming is Bill Cobb, my farm manager. In the first place, he's a master mechanic. That's one thing that a farmer has to be. Instead of being a handyman and going out in the snow to pick up a calf. Of course, you know, now it's also mechanized. They make sure they keep the bull penned up about 8 or 10 weeks so they won't have their, they won't calve in the dead of winter. They'll calve either in the fall or in the spring, usually in the spring, you know, so that they aren't exposed. And one of the things that's happened to this country, you know, once upon a time, this was great sheep country. We don't have a dog law in Mason County that's enforced. It's just terrible. That's why there's no sheep going in Mason County. The dogs are such marauders, they destroy them. When I first went to the farm, one of the delights was lamb shearing time. It was marvelous to see them and hear them bleating. It was adorable. And, of course, nobody renders lard anymore, but I can remember being a young woman on the farm and having men come there and cutting our own hogs and hanging them up on a clothesline, so to speak, and they were butchered there, and then those lovely globules of fat would be cut maybe about 2-inch cubes and be put in an enormous cauldron, and then they would bubble until the lard was rendered. And of course, my kids had such experiences, and I did too, as cleaning out the intestines of hogs. And then after you've made that damn sausage, you then stuffed it in all those casings. And I really always squirmed. I knew it had been sanitized, but I used to hate to eat that sausage. As a matter of fact, I don't care if I never eat any more pork as long as I live. In those old days, we not only had to eat old ham ad infinitum, but we also had to eat what they call shoulder. You ever hear what shoulder
is?
Yes. And then, of course, you had to eat that sausage. And what they did, because we didn't have refrigeration to that extent, they partially fried it, and then they let that lard come over the top of it, and that kept it, that sealed it, and you put it in a cool place. Uh-huh. And I can remember as a young woman, our having our potatoes down in the basement, and then and we've done such things in the early years of marriage as try to raise chickens, and then darn it, it would get cold, and we'd have to bring the chickens down into the basement near the furnace of the house, and it would smell up the house. You know, chickens smell to high heaven, and then you might lose a third of the return. So what I'm trying to say to you in the picture I really want to say to you is that I think farming is a wonderful career. It will have to always be, I think, now into the future, a second career. Mm-hmm. But as a way of life, I don't think it can be excelled. Because, A, he's an outdoorsman. He has to love nature. He has to care about animals. He's got to care about conservation. He knows the land is not his, it's only for posterity. He knows all these things. So that he's a farmer, and I'm thinking now, because my husband did not like farming, he had to work so hard as a boy. He worked hard. I've heard my husband say that as a boy, he never made more than $5 a month from his old man. Isn't that ghastly? Mm-hmm. Think of children today making $4.75 an hour, mm-hmm. and Pat's allowance was $5 a month. So, of course, both he and my brother-in-law, Francis, were sick of farming. They're not good farmers today. I mean, they don't want to care about farming. Anything else?
I've thoroughly enjoyed this, Mrs. Coleman. I've learned a lot, and
I don't know.
Anything else you'd like to add?
About anything
that you might recall from the past of farming? We talked about what.
Well, what I think is so wonderful, one of the programs that I hope will not be destroyed, and it may well be in peril, is our extension program. I'm talking about the magnificent job that Lillian Rice did. See, I've been associated with the home, with the what they call the extension program here since it started here. I think in maybe early 1920s, but we didn't have a home economist such as Lillian Rice.
What was the role with this agency with the farmer or the farm?
Well, of course,
family?
You see, I can remember going to my neighbor's house, and if some just had to carry in water from outside, and before we had a water district, we had to depend upon a cistern. And if you forgot to let the drain pipe go into the cistern, dear God, you'd be out of water. You know what it was like even when we had a bathroom to turn on the hose, turn on the faucet, and there'd be no water there. And then my husband had to go to town and get two or three barrels of water, and the children would be taught they must not let the water run while they brush their teeth. Or you had to wash maybe in just a basin. See, you couldn't take a real full-time bath because you couldn't let that much water be spared. And of course you can't do things like grow roses in the country unless you happen to have less water. And of course this is why see, I can remember when we had home economics here and all those women had their pictures up close to the wall, and they if they had anything they just had a hand pump in the kitchen, and so in order to make it look less barren they made little skirts around wherever they would have a wooden board on top. This is the sort of thing that they had. And so what do we have now? We have the homemakers here. There's over 800 members belonging to the homemakers here. And what are they? They have studied diction. They know how to refinish furniture. They know how to go out. I'm thinking of somebody named Mrs. Barker. She'll go out in the field, and she'll make all her own clothes. Mm-hmm. Those are the people who really ought to interview. I'm a Johnny-come-lately to the farm. But I admire these women extravagantly. I go to their annual homemakers dinner, and they stand up there with all the poise in the world, and they tell how much they've done. And think of the wonderful scholarships they do.
Mm-hmm.
Think what they've learned to do. They know how to make lampshades. They know how to do basket weaving on these caning on their chairs. They know how to. They know all about nutritious meals. They know what'll take a stain out of something, and in the early days, when they were just starting the program here, I used to have to write every month in the newspaper all the trouble of Pitching Homemakers Club. They were learning how to iron a shirt properly. You know how to iron a shirt. Of course, you people use drip dry, and I use drip dry too. But there's a certain technique to ironing a shirt. You know, I think you have to start with the arms first, and then you leave the front to back. I don't know, but I know that this tip have nothing but admiration for the farm woman. I think she's a terrific human being.
And this agency has helped her.
This agency has helped her more than anything. And of course, by the same token, think of what soil testing has done. All you have to do is take that dirt down there to, I can't think of Bill Peterson's office, and he can tell you, he can analyze your soil right away. Mm-hmm. Both the soil conservation districts that have been created have done far more than all this business about zoning and environmental EPA. Have done far more to make the farmer more knowledgeable about losing billions of acres of land either to macadam or to through been washed in silt down the Iowa River or some of our streams. Mm-hmm. They've done a lot towards that. So, and I find today's farmer an educated person. I mean, his wife is educated. She takes magazines. She's well dressed. She was stabbing her feet. She knows about vitamins. It's a tremendous program. I don't know of anything comparable in city living. And this is why we have so many city people who belong there. We have things like the Twilight Home. Those people are city people who have joined the homemaker because it is such a learning experience. Mm-hmm. I hope, but you see, it very well might happen. Our state university, what they call land grant colleges. Mm-hmm. You know what they are. You know what the land grant colleges is. So, of course, there may come a point in time and somebody up there in Congress is going to say, hey, we only have 3% of our population. We don't have to spend all this money on establishing a county extension office in every county in Kentucky. And maybe doing the same thing there that we're now doing with our health departments. You know, aren't we forming a five county health department here?
And merging.
Uh-huh. You may find more and more of that as you go along. But rural electrification in the Roosevelt years, and I cannot leave this problem without telling you that I grew up in the day of heroes, and Franklin Delano Roosevelt was my hero. Think of that cripple. Think of that rich aristocratic man descended from Dutch planters, man who could never walk, becoming president and doing the great things that he accomplished, and of course making the great mistakes that he made. I mean, you know, you can talk about now in retrospect 50 years later, but he changed the whole shape of the world. Maybe young people don't like paying Social Security he wasn't responsible for Medicare, of course. Or you don't like paying. But isn't everything subsidized? This is a question I want to leave you with. Is not everything subsidized? I was in a bank Monday this spring when a member of the airport board came in and said, I want to tell you, as I told the other members of the airport board, that I'm resigning from the airport board because I don't think that you ought to ask the federal government for more money in order to extend the airstrip out here at the Fleming Mason Airport. So let me leave you with this question for you to answer. Is not education subsidized? Our airways subsidized? Is not television subsidized? Is not everything? Are not our highways? Are not the truckers? Is not everybody in the world feeding, so to speak, in one way or another from the hand of a beneficent government? Mm-hmm. Isn't that true? And maybe we don't want it any other way. Maybe it can never be with our population being what it is.
Well, I certainly thank you.
I don't know.